This is Car Expert.
The old XC90 was really well known for. It's just a big, safe, comfortable, premium vehicle, and this new one brought it into the new age.
I think they'll probably try and match Tesla on price and probably have an Apple tax on top, so it'll be expensive.
The base automatic version of the top five light cars, the average price has gone up by 27% in the past 5 years, which is three times the rate of inflation.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner, and hello once again to Elbor's fella.
Hey, Mandy, how are you?
Very, very good. Hello, Tony Crawford.
Hey, Mandy. Our boy's been missing in action for about a year, so it's good to see him.
And I was in the last podcast. Twice.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. In a year is not bad, but we'll get used to it.
You just know this is going to be a long podcast because Tony and I are both on it. So, and it's going to be about nothing that we actually said we were going to discuss.
Well, I tell you what, I'm just in the Range Rover Sport SVR Carbon Edition. If you didn't know, there was a carbon edition, but there is. But
what's it like?
Oh, it's a beast. It's a 4.5 second 0-100 car. It makes a noise like there's a World War Five coming. it's probably my favorite performance SUV. There are much faster SUVs on the market, like the Urus, Lamborghini Urus, and even Porsche Cayenne Turbo, you know, but this thing, you know, it's the one that can actually go off-road and perform at high speed and corner fast and all that. There's nothing that can touch this thing off-road.
I'm sorry, but who in their right mind is taking a carbon edition Range Rover Sport SVR off-road?
Absolutely. Well, they are going off road to their, you know, $5 million country spread down at Kangaroo Valley.
Country spread these days for $5 million.
But look, it's a fantastic looking car, and it stood the test of time. I don't know how long I think it came out in 2012, 13. Maybe earlier than that. I remember going to the UK for its original Range Rover Sport launch this generation, but. You know, this thing is the top of the tree. It's incredibly expensive. This one with a few options at about $285. But, you know, it's the top of the pops when it comes to Range Rover Sports, and you pay for what you get. You know, what have you been driving, our boys?
At the moment, I'm driving an Alfa Romeo Giulia Q. It's this beautiful green. It's almost like British Racing Green, but a little bit darker.
That's one of the best looking cars on the road, by the way.
It got a lot of looks. I actually parked it in the city in Brisbane today and went to pick up something. And then on the way back, I saw these guys just walking around it. And I thought, you know what? If that was a 3 Series, that would never happen in 100 years. So as much as I love the 3 Series and I think it's a better car in every imaginable way, the Alfa definitely beats it for looks. It's such a good-looking car. And I love the wheels. I love the color. And the interior has got this beautiful tan leather. It's really nice. Color. It's so nice.
With that green, I was actually thinking about this today and, you know, what is going to happen to Alfa Romeo? Are they going to survive? And this is a brand that's dear to my heart. I started driving Alfa Romeos, but in the
1949.
In the early to mid 70s, I got drives of my father's farm manager had a 1750 and a 2000. The little two door. I think they were called Giulietta's, and they were fantastic cars that had driver feel and feedback like nothing else on the road at the time. And, you know, just thinking about the Giulia that Alborz is driving today, it is the best looking mid-size car on the road, and yet why doesn't it sell?
I can tell you, as an example, in Brisbane, there is not a single Alfa dealership in Brisbane.
There you go.
You're kidding.
No, there's not one Alfa dealership in Brisbane. So, I mean, who on earth would, in their right mind, buy an Alfa Romeo when you can't even get it, when you can't even go to a dealership to buy it here? You know, like the only ones on the sunny coast, which is just ridiculous, or Gold Coast, I can't remember.
But that's a tragedy in itself, right? You've got a fantastic looking car with all these reasons.
But Tony, that's all it is. It's a fantastic looking car, but you get inside and it's a generation behind. Yeah. Even the C-Class, that's already a generation old. And it's two generations behind the new 3 Series, which has got so much more tech in it. So, and people really do care about that. Like, as good as the Alfa is, I feel like when I drive it, I'm driving something that should have come out in 2010. And it's no longer that modern.
And do you think their reliability has a question mark over it?
At the old place, formerly known as Car Advice, now Drive, we bought an Alfa Romeo, if you remember, Tony, and it spent the first, I think, 4 months of its 6 month life at the dealership.
You couldn't close the actual sunroof. This was a brand new car, Mandy, that we paid good money for.
But the funniest part of that was he went to the Alfa dealership, and obviously they were aware of who we were, so they were pretty keen to fix it. They gave Tony another car to drive back, and Tony broke that one too. That one broke down, if you remember.
As I said, I'm a fan of the brand, but you know, would I buy one over a 3 Series or a Mercedes-Benz C-Class or a Audi even? No. You just couldn't. We haven't talked about residual values. You know, try looking at residual values.
One thing I should tell you is I spent the last week trying really hard to buy an Alfa Romeo 4C Tributo, the last 4C. I've been on the hunt. I thought I got one. I thought I got number one, but as it ended up being the guy who has it, wants to make too much money on it. So that didn't happen. But I was really, really keen to buy that 4C because I actually think that would be the last great naturally aspirated Alfa coupe. And if I could still find one, I will buy one. But there's some cars that company makes that I just think nobody else can make, and the 4C is certainly one of them. But it's a shame. You know, they've announced it going all electric. Their future's sort of up in the air. It's just not one of those brands that you could – You'd have to be a car enthusiast, and you'd have to buy it, and you'd have to have another car as a backup. And I know that sounds crazy, but it's actually just a fact.
Yeah. It's a real shame with that brand because it has a storied history of racing, even before Ferrari, I might add. I mean, Enzo Ferrari worked with Alfa Romeo back in the day in the 30s and 40s, and they were winning Formula One races, Grand Prix races in the day. And to think a brand like that is teetering on the edge of survival, it kind of brings a tear to your eye, you know, and to see these storied brands, you know, literally on their deathbed, as it were, and not knowing what the future is for them. And is it, you know, the whole idea of the Giulia was supposed to, you know, be the resurgence of Alfa Romeo. And, you know, the Stelvio was supposed to be their big win, you know, because everyone was buying SUVs, so maybe they'll buy an Alfa Romeo SUV, and they just haven't, right? And that's also a good-looking thing. I'm sure Marchionne, I don't know what he'd be doing now if he was still around, but because he had great hopes for that brand. As a lot of Alfisti did around the world, they want to see that brand survive. But, gee, I don't know what you could do right now to, no matter who you were, whether you're Houdini or Marchionne himself coming back, I don't know how you would make that brand survive. Do you?
No, it's – look, I don't know. I don't know. It's really difficult to put that – in perspective, because the brand is so good and it's got so much heritage, but that doesn't seem to matter anymore. So
yeah.
Well, can I on another sad note? I was looking at my Service New South Wales app last night and hoping I'd have some more points added to my more points that I could lose added to my license. And sure enough, I've received another fine. That's another speeding fine. Mobile camera in a very straight bit of safe road near me on Sydney's northern beaches, and apparently I was caught speeding at the speed of under 10 k's over.
We've got to say, what car were you in when this happened?
I was in my very old antique 2012 911 Carrera S, and I was driving with my Italian next-door neighbour to get some bread locally, and I know exactly where it was. It was a mobile speed camera, and it consumes yet another point from me. I feel like Roy next door is about 73 years old. I drive very, very slowly
Did you go to the same high school together then, too?
No, we did. and I just think, you know, here's when you're really trying not to exceed the speed limit and you still get done. And I may have been doing, it didn't have the actual speed recorded speed. So I could have been doing 4 or 5 Ks over the speed limit. And, you know, that I might have been doing that speed for 1 second before backing off further. So I just think it's so unfair. And, you know, Mandy, does it lead us into this other story that is also dear to my heart?
Maybe it does, yeah. We'll get stuck into car news right now because this government report is saying basic errors, not speed, cause 70% of road deaths. This is probably really not a surprise considering the world of mobile phones and lack of driver training, etc.
Yeah, 100%. I back in the day, was so taken by the road deaths and so annoyed that it was all about speed from state governments, always blaming speed, never blaming the fact, oh, gee, the road mightn't have been maintained for the last 20 years or we've resurfaced it so many times that it's now a hill rather than a flat piece of road. I wonder if that could cause a steering wheel to veer off into a tree late at night on a country road. You know, it's really about education, and people like Mark Scaifen, the chap out of Top Gear.
Steve Pizzotti.
Yeah. Has been banging on about driver education. I did a car show back on Channel 10 in 96 with Kevin Bartlett, the ex-racing driver, called Drive Safe. And it was a show that had Kevin as an ex-high-performance racing driver, V8 supercar driver, Can-Am Grand Prix winner, and he was explaining the basics to people, like how to hold a steering wheel. And I'm sure you've all seen your mother or friends of yours that hold the steering wheel with two hands at the top of the wheel or
Tony, we've got the world's most popular automotive TV movie franchise, Fast and Furious, showing people how to hold the steering wheel completely the wrong way. Just ridiculous. You watch those movies and they're like, oh, my God, like that's just so poor. They don't know how to hold the wheel properly. No. And then they also go to space in a car, so the movies are absolutely ridiculous now. But I couldn't agree with you more. I think the concept that speed is the leading cause of accidents has been shoved down our throats for so long without any actual factual evidence. Of course, you can't have an accident without moving, in which case you can always say speed's a contributing factor. But the fact of the matter is the majority of accidents today are inattention or human error. They have nothing to do with excessive speed. And, you know, the draconian sort of way in which we police speed at the moment, as you just found out recently, is nothing but a revenue-raising scheme. And I think we all know it, everyone talks about it, and yet we all still accept it. And that really upsets me. It's kind of like an Australian cultural thing where we all go, oh, well, I guess that's the thing, right? And then someone will say, well, if you don't do anything wrong or if you don't speed, you won't get a ticket. And that's just nonsense.
Yeah.
It genuinely is nonsense.
And instead of spending the money and making people do an advanced driving course, you know, there was years ago that the advanced driving courses were seen, oh, they'll promote people to drive even faster. Nothing could be further from the truth of knowing how to I doubt the average person on the road knows how or what ABS brakes actually do for you. They allow you to go full brake with your foot as hard as you want and actually steer the car while your foot is on the brake. And I guarantee that's not taught when you go for your driving test. And how many people do an emergency brake stop before getting their license ever or drive in the rain and hit the brakes? You know, the way we're doing it is wrong and it's causing deaths. And if you look down at the figures, the number of people killed on Victoria's roads each year since 2015, 252 were killed in 15, 290 in 16, 259 in 17, 266 in 19, and 211. We had a drop in 19 down to 211 for 2020 on Victoria's roads. Now, funnily enough, they've put, you know, we saw increased road tolls going up for years when they were adding more and more cameras, and our boys just said it. We all know it. The governments are just putting in more and more cameras because they are an absolute windfall when it comes to to revenues for the state coffers. An absolute windfall. And you wonder when they're on straight stretches of road, well, you know, maybe there hasn't been an accident there in 5 to 10 years, and yet we see this proliferation of mobile speed cameras and, you know, police cars now with the front bonnets are completely devoid of any livery, of any police livery, so that we don't get to see them. And yet in England, all the police cars are covered in fluoro so that everyone that sees a police car on the freeway slows down within kilometres of seeing the car. And yet here they want to entrap the lone individual that's, maybe a little bit late driving 5 or 10 Ks over the speed limit, getting to a job, and he's been pulled over and slapped with, 5 points and $1,000 fine. And he's the really bad guy that seems to be punished more than actual criminals at heart. Now, I don't walk away from the fact 1 minute that speed contributes to deaths on road. It does if you're exceeding the speed limit, by 50 or 60 Ks an hour. But then you've got to take into account, the level of electronics today that help cars stay in a straight line, and of course people dying when being protected by airbags and all the active safety systems that are on most cars now.
There's one really scary thing that I found going back to the driver training aspect of it. I don't know what it's like in New South Wales and Queensland where you guys live, but Vic Roads here with their learner permits, because of COVID, you now can take the test online. So you don't get any time behind an actual car to learn how to do a 3-point turn or, when to give way to pedestrians, all those sort of things. It's a 5 or 6 hour online course.
Your full test online?
Mm, because of COVID.
Oh, wow. Really? Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah. I know.
You don't actually have to show them you can drive the car.
Not from what I read. I didn't look into it really deeply, but from what I saw in a summary,
that's worth a story on its own. I didn't know that. That's quite fascinating. They should almost just follow them in a car behind as part of the testing process and talk to them with a walkie-talkie. That would make a lot more sense to me. But there you go. Well, look, I think we could talk about speed as a 15-hour podcast. Ultimately, I think our position is pretty clear. We don't believe in low-level speeding tickets. They don't really prove anything. And we've all driven overseas enough to know that, Germany has the highest speed limits and a lower death per capita than Australia on the road. And if that doesn't tell you everything you need to know about the causation of speed and fatalities, then you don't understand basic statistics.
Hmm. Yeah, 100%.
Okay, now moving on to the next story, Alboz. I know you're a bit of an Apple fan, so this one you'll enjoy talking about. Well, we all are, correct.
Yeah.
Apple is in talks with Korean suppliers for its first car. We've been talking about this Apple car for a long time. What's the latest update with this one?
Yeah, look, this has been a story that's been evolving over a number of years now. Apple has been working on a car. It had a whole bunch of people working on a car, and then it fired them all and started again. And the project got canceled at one stage, but it has been an ongoing thing for a number of years now. The latest is that the company actually sent people out to Korea for really advanced meetings to lock in who was going to be the manufacturer for the car itself. And I think being an Apple car, obviously it's going to be absolutely laden with technology. So it's probably more about the tech than the car itself. As Tesla's proven, the actual components of building an EV, I should take this and start from the scratch almost. It's going to be a full electric car. So Apple's not building a car with a combustion engine. It's going to be a full electric car. And I guess it's about trying to work out who in Korea is going to build it. There was a lot of advanced talks with Hyundai and Kia as a group. There's potential there for, whether it's going to be Samsung as well helping or LG with the batteries or anything like that. But ultimately, there is a car coming. It's going to have an Apple logo on it. There's a very good chance it's going to be very, very advanced levels of self-driving. And it'll be really interesting to see how that goes. But personally, I am very much looking forward to see how they're going to price it because I think it's not going to be cheap.
What sort of money would you spend on an Apple car, Alboz?
Well, obviously they're going to have a range. They're going to come out with one to start with. I don't know. If they were smart, they would come out with an SUV because that's what people want, but it's never sexy to launch with an SUV. So it's very likely they're going to come out with a sedan, like a Model S style car to get going and showcase their technology and then build upon that. I think they will probably try and match Tesla on price and probably have an Apple tax on top. So I think it will probably cost more than a Model S if it's an equivalent size or a Model X. So it'll be expensive.
On Apple Insider, I'm just looking at Alexander Hitzinger, formerly of Porsche, now said to be working on Project Titan. They must be pulling out all stops for this and going to make it look good, you'd have to think.
So they should too. Has to be good for their first launch. And to round out the news, we're going to bring in Mike Costello. Hello, Moco.
Hello, guys. How are we?
How are we, Moco?
Very, very good. Now, it looks like you've spent a lot of time on this news story, so we thought we'd actually get you on to talk about it. It's titled, Government Accused of Prioritising Dealers Over Consumers as It Pushes for Franchise Reform. Can you give us a little bit of a simple rundown of what this story is about for us?
Can I just give some context to this? Because I was originally put down to talk about this story, and I read it and I couldn't work out what you were talking about, so we actually called you back so you could talk about it.
Well, you know, we're quite a highbrow publication here at Car Expert Al Bors, and if it goes over your head, I mean, I'm sorry to hear that.
Mate, I write for the simple man. You know, as a simple man myself, I write for the simple man.
You're anything but simple, champ. Crawford, on the other hand. No.
Thank you, Moco.
So
I thought you were a supporter of mine.
Oh, I am. No, look, it's very dry stuff. I think it's important that we keep, a foot in the industry camp. It's certainly not something that we talk about as much as a lot of the other aspects of the car industry, but some of this really dry government-based industry affecting stuff is quite interesting. And one of the things that's been getting pushed lately by the Morrison government is reform to automotive franchising, which sounds incredibly dull, but basically what it means is giving franchise car dealers more power to address what the government sees as an imbalance of power between them and big international car brands with really deep pockets. A lot of this comes from when Holden decided to quit the country, and then when a lot of dealers took them to court and said, hey, our compensation's not very good, General Motors basically just waited them out and used what the government sees as its, you know, unfair amount of power to screw over smaller franchisees. And so the government recently introduced a bunch of things to tighten this up, and it's just put out a discussion paper asking for industry feedback on taking this even further. So what they've proposed to do is remove car dealerships from the existing franchise protections, legislation stuff, and create an entire new framework just for car dealers. And they've also introduced something called mandatory binding arbitration, which allows them to basically make a decision if there's a fight between a car company and a dealer and make that the final word to resolve disputes. What's come out of this is the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries, which basically represents all the car manufacturers, has said, hey, you're kind of forgetting about consumers in all this. You're talking about protecting dealers, but does over-regulating something actually stifle innovation? And will it discourage car manufacturers from innovating and coming up with creative new ways to sell cars? Or might it just encourage car brands to do what Tesla does and just forget dealers altogether and go direct to the consumer? So while this stuff sounds really, really dull, what it's actually doing is it's putting the current conservative government into an alignment with the dealer groups, getting the car manufacturers a little bit offside in the process. And then it ties into this wider issue of how are people going to buy cars in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years time compared to the ways they do today. So the story was a little bit vague, and we didn't really want to take a stand on it so much as just lay out the issue as it is, which is probably why it was a little bit technical and jargon laden, which I freely admit.
We always want to keep up to date with all the industry news because we know people in the industry listen to the Car Expert podcast, so I think it was well worth covering.
I also think anyone who's still listening to this is probably falling asleep against the steering wheel, so maybe we should move on.
Well, the main reason we had you on
so
is...
So insightful, Moco.
The main reason why we had you on, Moco, was to talk about a piece that you've been researching on car prices over the last 5 years and how it's differed. It'd be interesting to also find out what's happened during COVID as well. So what have you found?
Yeah, look, so everyone knows cars are way more expensive now than they were 5 years ago, and a lot of that's because of supply v demand, the most basic of all economic ideas. At the moment, there's not a lot of supply in the country, which drives up prices. Also, vehicles have become a lot more high-tech over the past 5 years. We've seen the introduction of particularly active safety features across basically every car on sale, and There's obviously a trickle-on effect that gets applied to the car buyer, and there's a whole bunch of other variables around exchange rates and things like that too. But I wanted to sort of quantify this. How much have the average car prices actually changed over the past 5 years in real terms, and also when you take inflation into account? And what I found was when I took the top 20 selling vehicles, I took the recommended retail price from 2016 and the recommended retail price in 2021 and applied it across base level automatic versions of all 20, only half of them increased in price at a rate that was higher than inflation being taken into account. Hmm. In other words, if you go on the Reserve Bank of Australia, they've got a great little website. The average CPI or inflation is 1.7% a year. On a compound basis, that means there's been a 9% increase in something over the past 5 years, and only 10 of the top 20 selling cars increased by more than 9%. So while there are a lot of variables in here in terms of discounting and special offers and all these sorts of things, these variables that come into it, in actual fact, only half the top 20 cars on sale have gone up in real terms. Where we've seen the real price increases occur are at the cheaper end of the market, the lower volume, lower margin end of the market, I should say. So light cars and small cars, very, very skinny margins. Any cost pressures are going to get applied more here. And what I found was the average price increase of a base automatic version of the top five light cars, that's the Kia Rio, Mazda 2, Suzuki Swift, Toyota Yaris, and Volkswagen Polo, the average price has gone up by 27% in the past 5 years, which is three times the rate of inflation. And then in the small car market, i30, Civic, Neo, Mazda 3, Toyota Corolla, and Volkswagen Golf, the average is 16%, so almost double the rate of inflation. So to come back to it, quantitatively speaking, small and light cars have gone up at a rate way higher than what mere inflation would suggest, but other cars, not so much. So this notion that all cars are unanimously more expensive, looking at the data, actually is just a little bit of a furphy.
Right. Very interesting. It's a little bit of a digression, but back in 1995, a Mercedes-Benz SL convertible was $270,000. I don't know how much convertible SL Mercedes-Benz is today.
What year was that?
Were you looking at buying one in 1995, champ?
We were testing it for Behind the Wheel, the motoring series I had on Channel 10.
And, but no one watched. Can I just point out no one ever watched it?
It's actually 2.1 million people watched my series, the largest audience in Australia today, but I digress again. The point is, Moko, that is a long time ago, and that was 250 grand.
You could buy two houses in Brisbane for that back then. That'd be worth
about 3
mil now.
That's what I'm saying.
Wow.
When you say
that's right,
car prices have gone up a lot, sometimes they were cheaper 25 years ago.
So this is why I chose that five-year window, and you're exactly right, Tone. So we know that the price of cars up until about 2016, car prices were at the lowest they ever were around then in real terms. You know, a Nissan Pulsar was $99,990 in 2013-14, and it was the same price in the early 90s. So,
yeah.
But there's a sense in the last 4 or 5 years, as in exchange rates have bit and our currency's gone backwards, as, you know, we've had lots more demand and a lot less suppliers, lots more technology has come into vehicles. And over the past half a decade, prices have spiked. And we know that that has happened based on what we've seen from manufacturers charging, but also just what we're hearing from people who are out there buying. So I thought it would be interesting just to try and attach a bit of data to it. It's a very flawed measure, I admit, because there are so many variables, you're never going to get it 100% right, but it at least gives us some idea of what types of vehicles have been increasing more than others.
Very interesting. Well, we look forward to that piece being published very soon on Car Expert Moko. How long do you reckon that might be till we see it?
Oh, we'll see. I'm just chipping away at it on the side, so I can't promise anything. Look, it could all be complete bunk. I need to get someone who actually knows what they're talking about to go through it first as well.
It's actually good that we've spoken.
We're looking to hire some people like that shortly, so it should be okay.
Exactly.
Mike Costello, thank you very much.
Great to see you all. See ya.
The Volvo XC90 is starting to get on a bit, 5 years into its second generation, but it appears to be still a pretty good thing. James Wong has driven the plug-in hybrid XC90 Recharge, and he joins us now. Hello, J-Wo.
Hi, everyone. How are we all?
How are you? Can I just quickly pop in there saying that XC90 is just like a big private bus, you know, and J-Wo said he's been enjoying it. He's a single guy. Why is he enjoying an XC90?
Because it's great. It's a great car.
But is it really a bus?
Maybe more of one of those private coaches, if you're going to use the bus comparison. But
well,
I can Volvo understand.
Volvo make buses, by the way.
They do. They do.
They make all the buses here in. They make all the buses here in Brisbane. Yeah, absolutely. And they make good buses. I if that's a validation for an XC90, which one have you got, J-Wo?
So I had the Recharge, which is the plug-in hybrid, essentially the flagship model. And with that engine variant, you only get the R design package. So it kind of looks a little bit sporty. But even though they sort of plug it, pun intended, as like the pseudo performance model, because it's got like 300 kilowatts, it's much more of a big luxury bus rather than, an X5 M performance rival. But
can I just ask, what's the electric only driving range in that?
So officially it's 44 kilometers on the ADR cycle, but keeping in mind that this car got released in like 2015 or 2016, and they haven't actually made any changes to the drivetrain since then. So it's definitely on the shorter side, and in real world conditions, you'll probably see closer to 35 to 40 kilometers, depending on how you drive it. And I also had it in the dead of Melbourne winter. So I was leaving home in the morning to go to the gym at like 7 o'clock, and it was 1 degree outside. And it's well known that electric vehicles or, plug-in hybrids using electric power don't get as good range in very cold conditions. So, it was a really interesting week because I mentioned it a few weeks ago when I was on the podcast that I'd just come out of the XC90, and it was the first time that I'd A, reviewed and really driven a Volvo, and also B, it was my first review of a plug-in hybrid car. So a few firsts there for me, and it was just a really interesting experience to sort of teach myself how to live with a car like that.
Okay. I it's a performance flagship model you've mentioned. And it's a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle with a range of 40 Ks only. I mean, Jesus, what is the friggin' point of an electric only range of 40 K? Why bother at all?
But that would get me to work and back in a day, Croft.
Okay.
In the city.
Yeah, but you're carrying around two different powertrains for no reason. It's so silly.
It's a stopgap measure. And anyway, we'll talk about that when I talk about the Santa Fe, Fev.
Let me guess. That was amazing. Best car
we're not getting. No, I can't see the relevance of it at all. You know.
I digress
away. J-Wo, you can always drive my XC40. I'm a Volvo owner, so I can say this with absolute assurance that I do love the Volvo interiors, but the XC40 is probably the best looking of all of the Volvo SUVs in my mind. You might be,
Yeah. Well, in terms of like you said, they have really good interiors, and that's one thing I really loved about this XC90 is that even though, as I said earlier, this car is getting on a little bit in terms of its life cycle, the overall design and execution of the cabin in terms of the layout, in terms of the materials, the space, the comfort, the refinement on the road, it's just a really, really good car. And it sort of makes me think that, wow, like 5-6 years ago, this car was so ahead of its time. When you see some of the more recent releases, say one car that I tend to criticize a lot is the latest Mercedes products, especially the SUV, the larger SUVs that are now being built in America. They're just not always, depending on how you spec them, they don't always feel quite as high end as they should. And with in this spec at 100, it's 115 grand, so it's still a lot of money for a car like this, but it's tens of thousands of dollars cheaper than equivalent German rivals. And just like the Napa leather seats are really, really comfortable, offer heaps of adjustment. The second and third rows are genuinely comfortable for adults. And the way that, even though this car has stupidly large 22-inch wheels, when it's riding on air suspension, it's actually quite comfortable and very, very quiet, even on coarse chip roads. I took it on a road trip down to near Phillip Island in Victoria's southeast, and I loaded up with a couple of friends and a bit of luggage, and it was just a joy. And it's yeah. it's even though it's got a sporty body kit on it, it's the kind of luxury. It feels like a traditional luxury SUV. It's big, comfortable, quiet, and it's pretty, you know, neutral to drive. It doesn't feel overly sporty. It doesn't feel cumbersome. It's just a really nice, safe and secure thing to drive. And I think that's what Volvo, especially the old XC90, was really well known for. It's just a big, safe, comfortable, premium vehicle. And this new one sort of brought it into the new age and sort of keeps on with that philosophy.
Yeah, a lot of people, Volvo from their earliest days were also known as incredibly reliable vehicles. And it's something that Volvo themselves don't talk about a lot. They own the safety, they owned the safety adage for so long until everyone else caught up with all the, you know, the suite of active safety that every fairly expensive car has as standard these days. So they couldn't really use that, and I'm surprised they don't use that fact that they are very reliable. And if you look on forums and that, people generally don't have issues with Volvos. So we've certainly never had an issue in 4 years of ownership.
Yeah, but who has issues with any modern car, Tony? I think that reliability thing is a bit of an old story now.
I think you've had issues with every car you've ever bought, man.
Not really. We had the issues with that Land Rover a while ago with that Discovery Sport first gen. Other than that, like, my Jag's been super reliable. Things keep falling off it on the outside, but that's not really – that's just bad glue in the Queensland sun, really. It's not really anything reliability. You know what? It's got 2-year bloody service intervals, and I took it in to get it serviced after 1 year, and they wouldn't do it. They're like, oh, it doesn't need it. I was like, I don't care if it doesn't need it. Just do it. They wouldn't do it. So it's gone almost 2 years now without a service.
That's another discussion we'll have about changing oil at 15,000 and 20,000 Ks. And the experts I speak to say that's utter rubbish, and oil definitely goes off much quicker than 15,000 Ks, and you should change it. And he says actually that if you read the book, the owner's handbook, it says in arduous driving, and they count arduous driving as stop-start city traffic, and it should be changed within those circumstances within 5,000 to 7,000 Ks. So another discussion, but very interesting. But anyway, look, the Volvos are exceptional. Like you said, the quality, the comfort, the seats are arguably the best in the business in terms of.
You'd almost think that Tony was the one that drove it, James.
I digress again. It's the easiest segment, a review segment that I've ever had to do. I don't actually have to speak much, but before Croft takes over my writing again, I just wanted to touch on the plug-in hybrid aspect, because obviously that's one of the main differences between this XC90 that I drove and other models in the range, and also various other cars in the segment. So, as Croft said, and we sort of established this, that a 44-kilometer range maximum is quite short in this day and age. Maybe 5 years ago it was fine when it was a new emerging technology, but now it's sort of getting on a little bit. So for me, I tried to see how far I could actually get it without charging it, and then seeing if I could match the advertised fuel consumption claim of 2.1 liters per 100 Ks. Yeah, 2.1 liters per 100 Ks. Driving to and from the car expert office in South Bank in near Melbourne CBD. So from where I live in Melbourne's east to the office, it's about a 24-kilometer commute each way. And there's a pretty lengthy stint on the freeway, and then you sort of head into the city bit, which is maybe the last 5 or 7 Ks. So 20 kilometers of freeway, 5-7 kilometers of city driving. So what I would do is I would charge it up overnight, and being a smaller battery, I could hook it up to just a normal 3-point wall socket, and it would charge up in about 3 to 4 hours overnight. So I'd wake up every morning, get to the car, and it had a full charge, and it would usually tell me that it had 35 to 40 Ks of electric range from there. So what I would do during the working week is that I would manage to get to the office on pretty much purely electric power, and still have about 5 or 10 Ks left. So to do the city part of the drive home again on zero emissions, and then the petrol engine would have to do most of the heavy lifting for that final freeway stint home. So during the week, I actually managed to get anywhere between 1.5 and 3 litres per 100 Ks on the trip computer, which is pretty incredible when you think that this car is like 2.4 tonnes, can carry 7 people, and, you know, it has quite a bit of power on it when you combine the two power sources. When I took that road trip over the weekend, it sort of went up to about 5-6 liters by the time I finished driving the car, and I'd done about 600-700 k's by the end of my time with it. But that was also including a stint on the way home from my holiday destination, we'll call it, where I had actually put the drivetrain into charge mode. So I spent half an hour on the freeway with the car actually charging the battery, and I got about half of the battery charge left within 30 minutes and then saved it for when I got closer to home and shut off the petrol engine and everything. So I think what I know Alborz doesn't really believe in plug-in hybrids, and I think Paul's very similar as well. You sort of – it's an in-between thing where you just go electric. But I think for a lot of people where they're maybe not necessarily afforded the option in a model's lineup to have an all-electric version, or, you know, a lot of the European brands don't do normal hybrids like Toyota. They've just done plug-in hybrids. I think if your use case matches the benefits of a system like this, where for five days a week you're driving to your office, or you're driving within 20 k's of your house, and you can pretty much do it all on electric power, and then you sort of have a range extender with the combustion engine for any longer trips, it really does make a lot of sense. And it, specific to the XC90, within its competitive set, there actually isn't another vehicle in the segment that offers a plug-in hybrid and also seven seats. The BMW X5 and the Range Rover Sport both offer plug-in hybrid options that are tens of thousands of dollars more expensive to start with, but you also can't get it with seven seats. And even though this has the battery pack under the boot floor, it doesn't impede on the passenger room. So it's one of the few cars that I've sat in that I can actually fit at 6'1", 6'2" in the third row with reasonable comfort. My hair was touching the ceiling, but I've got a lot of hair. I'm like Croft. So I didn't have too many issues there. But yeah, so overall, I was really impressed by it. I enjoyed having the experience of living with an electrified vehicle that required plugging in. And I think that for a lot of people who may be scared to make the full jump to electric, this something like this, perhaps with longer range, because that's probably the main thing I'd knock it for with in that regard, that it's something that you could probably, I would say, you can still consider, even though some people don't believe in the tech.
Okay. Wrapping up, Jaywo, what car expert rating did you give it?
I ended up giving it an 8.5 because perhaps if it was one of the other engine drivetrains, it might have gotten even more because they would be cheaper, and also the shortcoming of the plug-in hybrid's range may have raised the score a bit. But I think even still now, there's an all-new one coming in a couple of years that's going to be all-electric, or at least offer an all-electric version. But I think that it's just still such a good car. So,
sorry, Joey, what was the 0 to 100? What's the performance of this thing?
It is.
Given that you said it was the high performance, and is it any quicker than a T8 R Design XC90?
It is a T8 R Design XC90. They just call it a different thing. It is, okay. Yeah, so they claim 5.5 seconds 0 to 100, which if you put it into its power mode, it does feel pretty fast. I didn't put it against the stopwatch myself, but it definitely feels fast enough. Faster than my Golf GTI. Yeah, it's a quick thing considering how big it is. So
yeah.
Okay. Fantastic. Cool. That review is now up at carexpert.com.au. Thank you, James Wong. And there goes another Car Expert podcast. Well, I suppose so this time next week, gents, we'll be talking about the Nissan Z and what it looks like, because in a couple of days from this podcast recording, it'll be revealed. So it's going to be a big story.
It is going to be a big story. I'm looking forward to seeing that. I think it's going to look very much like the concept photos we've seen to date. Just as a side note before we sign off on this podcast, I just wanted to point out while we were recording this, they actually turned Car Advice off. So for anyone that's come over to Car Expert and listening to this, thank you. We will do a whole episode on that separately in the very near future.
Yeah. Okay, so some cars that we've got coming up in the garage over the next week. Boars, what have we got?
Look, it's being locked down and all. We haven't really got too many great things coming. At the moment, we've got a Julia here in Brisbane. There's a Genesis G70 here as well. We've got a D-Max. We've got a GW Ute Cannon and a Tucson Highlander next week. So nothing insanely expensive, but I actually, weirdly enough, really like that GWM Cannon. It's a cool Ute. I really like it.
Yeah?
I'll stick with my Defender 90 D250, thanks.
always the everyday man, Tony.
Are you going to take that off-road, Croft?
Off-road, Mandy, not with the COVID lockdown, I'm afraid. It's a painful situation, but I've got a 10K limit, I think, around here. So I'm very keen to see if the 90 is actually livable for someone with, you know, three people in the house and, you know, it's only $3,000 less than the 110. So I'm, you know, the value for money equation is questionable for me. So it'll be interesting to see if it actually has enough space to, you know, go surfing and all the rest of the stuff I do on the weekends.
Yeah, cool. I look forward to seeing the photos of the surfboard on the roof, Croft.
Indeed.
Elbows Fella and Tony Crawford, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Mandy. Been a pleasure.
Thanks, guys.